Well, you really have some story to tell. Of course, I've been following the case off and on in the newspapers and the wire services for some time, but here you put it all together with all the detail that you possibly could have. What is you work for the newspaper out there. Tell me about your background.
I worked for the Deseret News for 5 years before the bombings, and about the time they charged Hoffman, I left to work on the book. And I never worked the police beat or the court beat, but I was working on in-depth magazine stories on social issues of all different kinds. I'd done some on murder victims and their families, did one story on the family of the victim, the family of the perpetrator, and I'd just done a story on a Mormon con man, interestingly enough. It was pretty different from Hoffman. But I did enough of that kind of thing that I was acquainted with the county attorney's office and the police department, and I had contacts there, and was also somewhat acquainted with the ways that victims and families react to crime, which became important later, you know, something that I hadn't anticipated. So, but mostly I was doing stories on minorities, women, brain damage, you know, you name it, all kinds of things.
But you, this was a big story in Salt Lake.
Oh, yeah.
The story.
Yeah, it was incredible. Well, we had bomb threats for several days after the bombings. You know, the newspaper was evacuated once, but none of us working on the story had time to evacuate. We just kept on going. So
after, soon after he was charged, is that correct?
Yeah, see, it took 4 months before they charged him with anything.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time, I was working outside my department. You know, I was in the feature section on magazine stories. This was on the city desk. So I was trying to keep up with both departments, and the bombing story kind of died after a couple of months with no charges. And so I was kind of going back and forth, although it was still an investigative story, but not breaking news anymore. And I decided I couldn't put it down, and that if I, you know, had the chance to do a book, I was going to do it. And really, I'd reached kind of a ceiling there at the newspaper. I was ready to. I'd written a novel while I was there, sending that around. I was ready for the next leap, and there it was.
Mm, yeah, right, fell right in your hands, didn't it?
Well, it fell right on top of me.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the case itself. Can you give us the broad outlines of what happened in Salt Lake City with this bombing case and these forgeries?
Well, on Tuesday, October 15th, 1985, the two pipe bombs exploded that killed Stephen Christensen and Kathleen Sheets. And at that point, it appeared to be linked to the business that Christensen had just left, and which Kathy Sheets' husband, Gary Sheets, was president of, and which was going into bankruptcy. It was a financial institution. And so it was investigated in that light. However, it was also known that Steve Christensen had a year earlier purchased the White Salamander letter, which was an early Mormon letter that described Mormon origins in magical rather than strictly religious terms. So that was kind of a runner-up motive, that it might be something having to do with Mormon documents. The next afternoon, Mark Hoffman, the document dealer who had sold Christensen the letter, became the victim of a third bomb. And the plot thickened considerably, especially that night when he was charged, or accused, rather, of having set the two killer bombs the day before. And that third bomb that injured him really became the darkest part of the mystery, because it didn't fit any place. You know, it didn't fit with the business side. It didn't. If it had to do with Mormon documents, then why would Mark Hoffman be, you know, why would he run any risks? If he wasn't a victim, how could he be the suspect? I mean, it just didn't make sense no matter how you looked at it.
Of course, your detectives early on said that it's very likely that bombers blow themselves up.
Uh-huh, that's right. And the police were very suspicious of anyone who had a bomb in his locked car. And then the fact that Hoffman's account didn't jive with the physical evidence made them suspicious. Then when they searched his house and they found this green high school letter jacket that matched the description of one worn into the building where Christensen was killed by the bomber, they didn't like that either. But the problem was, even though they had the circumstantial evidence against Hoffman, he was a victim. He had contacts with high church leaders. He was ostensibly a good Mormon husband and father, businessman. As soon as he got out of the hospital, he passed a polygraph test. He had the oath of a freeman selling in the East for more than $1 million, hopefully, to the Library of Congress. He was a tough guy to have as a suspect. And so that's why it took 4 months before they broke the case enough to bring him to court.
How did they break the case?
Well, really, it was discovering the forgeries that gave them their motive. with a circumstantial case, you better have a motive. And it wasn't until George Throckmorton, who wrote our technical analysis, looked at several of Hoffman's documents that he didn't like what he saw. And he was a scientist rather than the authenticators in the East and in Utah who had looked at them. They came at it either from a more artistic or aesthetic point of view or a historical point of view. But from a scientific point of view, looking at the handwriting and so on, Throckmorton thought he saw similarities and he saw apparent anomalies. So he and Bill Flynn from Phoenix, Arizona got together and began looking at them under microscopes. They had a number of them to look at, you know, a stack of them. And pretty soon they found they could tell the Hoffmans from the other documents of that time period. And then they just had to find out why and be able to prove in court that he was, in fact, a forger.
Well, what about the papers and the inks?
Well, that was the problem. The paper was old paper. Often he removed it from books printed in the year that it was supposed to have come from. He would make his own inks according to recipes from that time period. And then he would age the ink with either heat or chemicals. The problem that Throckmorton and Flynn discovered was that the aging process to oxidize the ink so it would be that nice rusty color you see on old documents would actually crack it microscopically. And the treatment, washing it with chemicals, would cause the ink to bleed slightly when it was hung up. Now, none of this was visible to authenticators, but under the microscope, they could see these anomalies in the ink. And once they made that breakthrough, they began to find other problems as well. Negatives from which he'd had printing plates made. One of the order forms for that negative had his fingerprint on it, and the fingerprint was tied to a pseudonym, Mike Hansen. Mike Hansen had also purchased bomb parts. I mean, it all started coming together. A lot of it after they'd actually charged him.
A lot of Hoffman's documents were authentic, though, weren't they?
Only those he got in trade. Sometimes he got them in trade from the Mormon Church or from private collectors, and then he would deal those. But the ones that you hear about are all forgeries. And a lot of them are American documents.
What about the Oath of a Free Man?
Well, the Oath of a Free Man, although the people in New York who invested in it say they still believe it's authentic, matches microscopically a negative that's part of the investigation and which printed a second oath. We have two oaths of a free man. There's the New York oath, and there's an oath in Utah. Those are the same. They're made from the same plate. The police have the negative, which was used to produce the plate. And the handwriting on the back of the oath of a free man in New York, which we call Oath 1, is cracked in the same way that the holographic documents are. So my judgment and the judgment of the experts would be that that's a fake, too.
So Hoffman was a master forger, but that doesn't explain why he set those bombs off.
Right. Well, he's a better forger than bomber. He set off the bombs because he was selling a non-existent collection called the McClellan Collection, and he could not get out of the deal. All during 1985, he sold non-existent collections. There was a Daniel Boone collection, a Daniel Boone letter from that collection, which is probably the only thing he forged in it, was sold at Sotheby's in New York for around $40,000 after the bombings. And this McClellan collection was supposed to be very damaging to the Mormon Church. He sold it once. He needed to sell it again to pay off the investor. The Oath of a Freeman had not sold to the Library of Congress. He needed to get out of the deal with this McClellan collection that was ultimately going to the church, particularly because a high church authority had arranged a $185,000 bank loan for Hoffman to purchase the collection and then donate it.
Now, wait a minute. How can the church authorize a loan like that for a collection that nobody's ever even seen?
Well, that's the problem. It wasn't done by the church per se, but it was done by a top official in the church who simply called the bank and said, Mark Hoffman is coming over. With him came Steve Christensen, the first bombing victim, who became middleman in that deal. Now, having that bank loan leaked to the press, after there had been a certain amount of controversy already about Mormon documents and the idea that the church was hiding these documents, which is an idea that Hoffman had exploited, was a real problem. And so that deal became very high pressure. The church wanted it closed. Christensen was pressuring Hoffman. Hoffman couldn't close the deal. The Oath of a Freeman didn't sell. The bank loan had to be paid back. It was in arrears. And finally, he blasted his way out of the deal with the bombs that killed two people. The second bomb was simply to divert attention from the document deal toward the business.
But it doesn't explain it. I mean, how does setting off the bomb stop the deal?
It did stop the deal. And that's kind of the bottom line, that you look at that particular day, the only thing that changed for Mark Hoffman and all the pressures that were on him, which were considerable financial things that were going bad, was that the McClellan deal did not take place. That's all that changed. And that afternoon, he went back to the church leaders and said, you know, the police are going to be looking into this, and implied that everything better be kept quiet. Well, the church leaders believed, as the police did, that the bombings had nothing to do with Mormon documents. They set up the deal again. They replaced Steve Christensen and set up the deal for the next day, putting Hoffman back on the hook. The next morning, he drove to a city 90 miles north of Salt Lake, used aliases again, bought more bomb parts, built a bomb, came back to Salt Lake City with that bomb, and while everyone was waiting for him to bring in the McClellan collection, somehow got blown out of his car by that third bomb, and the rest is history.
Now, there was a plea bargain. If everybody knew that he had committed these murders as well as these forgeries, why did they allow a plea bargain?
Well, everybody didn't know until the plea bargain happened, but the police knew and the prosecutors knew, and there was a very strong preliminary hearing which bound him over for trial on 30 felony counts. The plea bargain happened for a number of reasons. I don't know how many of them you want, but number one is that the cases were complicated. There were five cases. The homicide case was, of course, the most important one. It would have been difficult to find an objective jury who could weigh the testimony of top church leaders equal to the testimony of anyone else, any other witness. Probably the most important thing was that Mark Hoffman, the forger, had something to trade on behalf of Mark Hoffman, the murderer. The lead prosecutor was fascinated by what Hoffman had done to Mormon history and by his Mormon forgeries. And he was also outraged by the fact that many people did not believe that Hoffman was guilty. They did not believe those documents were forged. And he wanted Hoffman to admit it and to explain his crimes, which he did in about 500 pages of depositions, only 14 of which deal with the murders. The rest are all about the forgeries, including the oath of a freeman. And so he traded 30 felony counts for 1 5-year-to-life sentence, which is a pretty good deal. And that plea bargain is very controversial in Utah. And a sense of justice was partially achieved just last January when he appeared before the Board of Pardons to see if they would set a parole hearing for him sometime in the future. They questioned him about the murders for 90 minutes and then essentially threw away the key. His answers were so chilling and callous and completely cold.
Yeah, what kind of person is Mark Hoffman? And he fooled everybody, too.
Well, Mark Hoffman is a guy who, as a little boy, learned that he liked to fool people. He liked card tricks. He liked magic tricks. He was brought up in an ordinary, middle-class, very devout Mormon home where things tended to be black or white. And Mark learned as a child and as a growing adolescent that the scientific explanations for the world were more persuasive to him than the religious ones. That was not tolerated in his home, particularly by his father. And he learned to bait his father. He learned to feel superior to his father's faith with his own scientific knowledge. And he also learned to please his parents by being the boy in church who knew all the answers, who knew the scriptures, who would become an Eagle Scout, who would fill a mission for the Mormon Church in England, and outwardly please everyone while inwardly satisfying his own agenda, part of which was to reshape Mormon history in the way that he believed it had really happened without the miracles and the visions that are part of the traditional Mormon account.
Have all of the Hoffman forgeries been found?
I really doubt it.
To what degree has he altered Mormon history?
Well, the Mormon forgeries, it's difficult to say. There are at least half a dozen books that have been published in the 1980s that include Hoffman documents, either in the text or the documents themselves. And it's had a significant impact. It will take a while to sort that out, and to now that we have to rewrite history again. In terms of his American documents, the investigative reports since the bombing show that there probably are a number of American documents hanging in galleries throughout the country. He forged inscriptions and books. There's a Francis Scott Key signature on the Star-Spangled Banner, a Betsy Ross letter, the Daniel Boone letter I mentioned, that are known to be Jim Bridger notes. I mean, they're all the way across the board. So I think the extent of his forgeries is not yet known. There's probably a book yet to be written about Hoffman and Americana documents.
Well, what a real disservice to scholarship.
Yes. Yes, a lot of scholars and historians have really gotten a black eye, and so have collectors and dealers and polygraph experts. And, you know, this has been a very tough case for experts in various areas and church leaders.
Are they still talking about the case out in Salt Lake?
Yeah. We've found that Salamander is moving very well in the West. It's just barely come out in the East. But the need to know is still very strong. What I've told you, you know, I've been giving you the inside stuff, the bottom lines, the things that most people are not that familiar with, and that took us a long time to find out. The third bomb especially was a real mystery. A lot of argument among the police and prosecutors.
Now, you worked on Salamander with a partner, Alan Roberts.
Alan Roberts,
what was
right.
his role in the book?
Alan was on what we call the history grapevine. He was a friend of Steve Christensen's, who was very interested in the Mormon documents. And so his particular angle was the history and the documents themselves. He assisted in the research and the interviewing, which was very extensive, and really went on from the time of the bombings until the end of January of 1988.
Now, you at the end of the book, of course, you have a forensic analysis by George Throckmorton. What are some of the devices that he uses to determine forgeries?
He used magnification, ultraviolet, and infrared light, and these showed the cracking in the ink and the running. They also showed other anomalies. For instance, there were clip marks at the top of some documents showing that they had been hung while they were wet with chemicals. He used, of course, he compared the negatives that were found to the products. In one case, let's take the Oath of a Freeman, for example, since that's more familiar to your listeners, maybe. The Oath of a Freeman, they had the negative. They also had a proof that was taken from Hoffman's home that had editing on it, you know, written on it. And then they had the two oaths, the first oath and the second oath, that were found. Sometimes on some documents, they found rub-off letters in his house that had been used to produce the original artwork from which the plate was made, the printing plate. And they found all kinds of anomalies. One thing that was seen through the microscope on some of them were cut marks along the paper, because he would often remove paper from books and then trim it. And the Salamander letter, which became so famous and so controversial, the lines on that paper were actually drawn on. And that particular lined paper was extant in Palmyra, New York, which is where it was supposed to have been written. And that took a little research for him to have found that out. It took a lot of research for the experts later to authenticate it by finding that out. So he's a very careful forger.
You do say in Salamander, however, the Oath of a Free Man he purchased, I believe, at the Argosy Bookshop.
That's right. He had a receipt, a sales receipt, for the Oath of a Freeman, which he said he bought for $25. And he had the clerk at the store write that on specifically. He purchased a number of other items for, you know, a small amount of money. And he carried that receipt with him everywhere as a provenance for that document. The problem was that he had the plate made in Salt Lake City under the name Mike Hansen, I believe 8 days before, or 3 days before it was discovered in New York. And then he had it. There's one plate that was made 8 days, and then one plate made 3 days. He did it twice. He wasn't satisfied with the first one. And so when you line up the dates on this, you can see that he had the printing plate made the oath, brought it back to Salt Lake, put it, you know, in the bookstore, and then purchased it with some other things so that he had that provenance. And he then engaged the help of two book dealers in New York City to represent him in marketing the oath. And as far as I can tell, they recently published a letter in the Maine Antique Digest saying that as far as they know, that is authentic, and that's true. It passed the cyclotron test in California. The Library of Congress found nothing wrong with it. And since they were unwilling to cooperate with the authorities in Utah never shared with them the results of the tests that were done on the Oath of a Freeman back here in New York. So there you are. It's a very complicated case.
Yeah, and such temerity.
But as I say, it's identical twin is in the evidence in Utah, and they all three of them are microscopically consistent.
Well, it's a fascinating story. Make a great movie.
Yeah, that's what I think.
Well, let's keep our fingers crossed. Get an option on a movie deal. That would be great. It'd really be interesting. Well, it's a fascinating book, fascinating story, and you have it all summed up in the pages of a book. Linda Sillitoe, thank you very much.
Thank you.